This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about an issue that's been uppermost in my mind, and I know a lot of yours these past 3.5 years, and that's Bush's Iraq War and the occupation there. With me to discuss it is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, Anthony Shadid, who spent time in Iraq before the war, during the bombing, during the occupation, and in fact, he's just back from Basra. Anthony Shadid has written, to my mind, the definitive book on what Bush did wrong. That book is called Night Draws Near, and I highly recommend it. Anthony Shadid, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was it like to be in Basra recently?
You know, I had not been to Iraq for about a year, or a little less than a year, and so I wanted to do some work in Basra and also to see what the situation was like in Baghdad. And I have to say, it was startling. I don't think I'd expected the deterioration or the scale of the violence that was actually going on at this point.
In both places,
but in particular Baghdad. Basra was more kind of a free-for-all, I think, a free-for-all as these militias, all of them Shiite, but as these militias were, you know, engaged in a contest for power and influence and money. Baghdad feels much bleaker in some ways. It's a city that's in my mind, just kind of gone over the edge in a way. I've always been struck as a reporter, I think, in Baghdad is how resilience defined that city. During some of the worst days of bombing, during the invasion, the next morning people would wake up, they'd open their stores, life would have this veneer of normalcy. When I was in Baghdad this trip, it just didn't have that anymore. The city itself had changed, and I think
it's funny because George Bush at a recent press conference was bragging about how safe the markets are supposed to be, according to General Abizaid. That wasn't your experience.
You know, it's funny. I think especially in 2003, you'd always hear people somewhat uninitiated or who were visiting Baghdad, for instance, they would be looking out their car window at this activity going on in the streets. There'd be traffic jams that would stretch miles. Their shops would be open. Goods would be, you know, flooding out onto the sidewalk. And they'd always point to this as, look, here's an example of the vitality that we're seeing of an economy that's booming. And I was always struck by that because, you know, they were seeing this, but they weren't hearing the voices in the streets. And there was a certain conceit in that, I thought. But today that conceit doesn't even hold. I mean, shops are shuttered. Traffic is visibly dwindling. I mean, it feels like a lot of the city itself has left, and it has. I mean, 6 million people have left the country, mainly for Syria and Jordan. So, you know, even that idea that you can look into the streets in Baghdad seems to be okay, that's not the case anymore.
How unsafe is Baghdad right now?
You know, it's incredibly unsafe. There's a word in Arabic that means hot, and that's basically when you talk to people, they ask, well, is this area hot? Is that area hot? And that means it's too dangerous to go into.
I think is that word?
Sukhna. And I think you see people, you know, there's some neighborhoods that if you're a stranger and you enter into that neighborhood, you'll be killed, mainly because, you know, you have your own kind of committees is too nice of a word to use, but their own squads that are trying to protect it, they see a stranger, they expect that stranger is there for the wrong reason, and they kill them almost immediately once you enter into the neighborhood. So vast areas of Baghdad are basically off limits to anybody who lives there. You know, that said, I think there's a notion in the States that journalists aren't getting out, and journalists still do get out. I mean, I was still able to go to places to visit friends.
So you got outside the green zone?
A little bit, yeah. It's, you know, you have to be very careful, and you can't stay in places for very long. But you do, you know, you can move around. I think, you know, women reporters will often wear the abaya, the traditional kind of black dress, and so they're not as noticeable. And I think, you know, for me, I think if you keep, you know, a somewhat low profile, you're able to get around a little bit and try to get a sense of what's going on at this point.
The risk, though, is still there, and how do you deal with that?
You know, you always try to have a sense of what's doable and what's not doable, and, you know, that always changes. You know, it's very, what's the word? It's very much of a gut feeling of what you can do. I'd wanted very badly to go see a friend of mine who was a professor at Baghdad University. He was in a neighborhood called Adhamiya, which is a very dangerous neighborhood. You know, you just think if somebody can drop me off, they'll leave me there. They'll come back and pick me up in a couple hours. It's okay to do. And it was. I went and visited him actually a couple of times. And, you know, reporters, of course, have, you know, their cars, their guards, their, you know, whatever. You know, for Iraqis are just, I mean, it's reached the point where Iraqis just in the streets are themselves scared. I mean, people don't walk the streets unless they have to. And I remember that drive back from Adhamiya. You know, I think it was about 7 o'clock. It was basically just after sunset. And I remember driving and thinking, this is what a street would feel like 2 hours before dawn. There was no one in the streets. I mean, no one in the streets. The streets themselves were dark. There were these snap checkpoints. You know, God knows who were manning them, shining flashlights into cars.
Not the government, probably.
No, these are militias. And, you know, at this point, police and militia, it's such a blurred line between them that you just never know who you're getting stopped by.
I'm speaking with Anthony Shadid, who is the Washington Post foreign correspondent stationed in Beirut, just back from Baghdad, who wrote this incredible book about the problems with the Iraq war and the Iraq occupation called Night Draws Near. I think it came out in 2005, but it was right on the money and predicted a lot of what's since transpired. Right now, Bush and the generals are claiming that the battle for Baghdad is the battle on the horizon right now and is going to be decisive. How do you see that?
It was interesting to me. I thought I think when people look back and they write the history of this war, they're probably going to think back to General Caldwell's comments in October when he got in front of the press corps in Baghdad and basically said he was disappointed with how it had gone so far, this very big campaign that they'd undertaken, military campaign in Baghdad to try to bring some semblance of security to the city. And I thought he was quite blunt in saying that it had not worked at this point. If anything, attacks have gone up. The number of deaths have gone up. The insurgency itself, although it's not only in Baghdad but also in the West and North, is raging. I mean, the American death toll is one of its highest points in months and months. You know, I think what I'm struck by as a reporter, and you always hate to state these opinions too strongly, but what I'm struck by as a reporter in Baghdad, at least, is that it has, you know. It's hard for me to see what is done at this point to bring a semblance of security to Baghdad, of course, but even to the other parts of the country. Forces that were unleashed by the invasion have reached maturity in a way, and it's a frenetic maturity, but they have reached maturity. And the idea of bending those forces back somehow or thinking that you're going to add 10,000 soldiers to do something like that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me right now.
It's interesting because Bush, at his recent press conferences, said it wasn't forces unleashed by the invasion, but it was lingering animosities from the Saddam era that need to be calmed down. It was as though he and his invasion had nothing to do with the problems embroiling Iraq right now. Would you describe it as a civil war?
You know, it's interesting. I was standing in Ferdows Square, which is, I think, some listeners might remember that, what that was. It's the square that Saddam's statue had toppled back in 2003. You know, I had gone there in 2003. I remember thinking that this was, and I think that's how most people perceived it. This was the moment that represented the fall of Saddam. And I'd gone back to that square a year later to do another story. And this was when the Shiite militia loyal to Muqtada Sadr was fighting the Americans in both Baghdad and southern Iraq. And Sunni insurgents were fighting in Fallujah. And it was a very unsettling moment in that same square a year later. Tanks were circling the square, barbed wire and concrete barricades. And I remember thinking, wow, this represents the occupation. This is, speaks to occupation today. And I'd gone back there just in this last trip, and I remember I was standing there, I was trying to think, what does it represent today? I mean, what is the word that describes what's going on today? And I just talked to a psychiatrist. I was trying to ask a psychiatrist, how do you make sense of this madness? And he said, well, of course it's a civil war. He said, hundreds of bodies in the streets, most of them tortured, some of them beheaded. I mean, awful, awful things, done to these people, drills to the head. He said, how else can you describe it? It might not be a civil war like Bosnia or Rwanda, but it is a civil war. But I remember I was standing there, and I just that didn't exactly work for me. And I think it's like what we were talking about a few minutes ago. What it feels to me, I mean, civil war feels to me in some ways too tidy, almost too easy of an explanation of what's going on.
North versus South in
exactly.
American terms, for instance.
And there are elements of that. I mean, you do have this sectarian-style killing that reminds me of Lebanon in the 70s and 80s. But I think what's more kind of explains the situation more is, like we were talking about, is this maturity of these forces that were unleashed by the invasion, this sectarian divide, this religious, the militancy of ideology at this point, gangland battle basically over turf that's being waged by militias that it doesn't matter if they're Sunni or Shiite. It's because it's not an ideological reason that they're fighting over. They're fighting over money, power, and influence. It feels like a free-for-all. And so I guess civil war would be one explanation of that, but it also feels much more chaotic, much more anarchic.
So in this free-for-all, Anthony Shadid, it's not just Sunni versus Shiite, or it's not just Al-Qaeda versus the U.S. or the Maliki government. It's some combination.
I think that's definitely right. And I think that's, in fact, I think I was talking to this professor that I mentioned I had had dinner with in Avamiya. You know, his fear was less the Sunni on Shiite and more the Sunni on Sunni and the Shiite on Shiite. You do see divisions and you do see rivalries among Sunni insurgents, for instance, in the West. You also see, we keep using this phrase, but a free-for-all in southern Iraq. I was down in Basra. And in Basra, basically what you have are parties, and every party has its militia. There are 19 parties. You know, their militias range from 100 people to thousands, low thousands of people. They fight it out by assassination, by intimidation. They control the police forces. I mean, one estimate I had heard when I was there last year was that 90% of the police force is basically in the hands of militias. And I think what happened in Amara, the Sadr militia had basically taken over the city in October. And I think that was an example of what we might see go on, is that, people often say that the Sadr militia could take over. They've always focused on the streets. They could take over any city in southern Iraq in a few days. Other militias have focused on the police force, the governor's office. But it is a very pitched battle for survival in a way. And survival at this point is a zero-sum game.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. I'm talking with Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post, author of Night Draws Near, who's been doing a lot of reporting over the last 3.5 years from Iraq. You mentioned the Sadrists. Muqtada al-Sadr, you say in your book that his ascent would in time write the epitaph for the American occupation. Why is that, and what is he like?
I think especially in 2004, when we saw those battles begin in April 2004 between Sadr's militia and the Americans, it did feel like that was, in a way, the climax of a part of the American project, or however we describe it in Iraq. You know, it was almost a mantra among the Americans in 2003 and 2004 that we can never lose the Shiites. They understood there was a Sunni insurgency going on, but you can't lose the Shiites. And I think what that revolt represented in a large way was the loss of the Shiites. You know, Sadr today is, it's interesting. I met Sadr, I think, a few weeks after the invasion, after the fall of Saddam. And, I was struck because his words were very strong. I mean, he made very clear that he was going to be antagonistic toward the U.S. presence in the country. But he was a young guy. I mean, he was in his 20s. I was always much more impressed by the people around him than he himself. And you were never sure what to make of him. Was he going to claim the mantle of his father, who was an incredibly powerful figure in the 90s in Iraq, later assassinated by Saddam? You know, would he claim that mantle, or would he be a fringe player? And, my sense was that he was speaking a narrative that I thought resonated, very well in Iraq. And my suspicion was that he was going to be a much more of a player.
Why did that resonate?
There was always the opposition in Iraq. And when I talk about the opposition, I mean the opposition the Americans had kind of engaged with before the invasion always had that taint of being allied with Iran, that they had actually fought with the Iranians during the war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s. Their reputation was hurt by their association with the Americans themselves, people like Chalabi, like Alawi. Even the Iranian-backed Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, what's called Skiri or Badr, everyone had this association with an outside power. Here came Sadr. It was a narrative that was very Shiite in a way, but it was also a narrative that had an Arab nationalist discourse to it, an Iraqi nationalist discourse to it. In some ways, it felt much more organic to me. And he also, his father was famous for engaging the poor. It was a street movement, and they were very conscious of being a street movement, this disavowal of formal power, and that we'll wage our battle in the streets. Sadr inherited a lot of those, and especially the men around him who were very close to the father. And it's still that today. Now, the militia, there's questions of how much does Sadr control the militia. People say he doesn't.
They don't think he does.
I don't think he does at this point. I think he's lost a lot of control, and they've turned into basically gangs that are killing hundreds and hundreds of Sunnis, and often horrifically. But Sadr probably is the single most important figure in the country today as a political figure. Like I said, his militia, even parts that he still controls, could take over any city in southern Iraq in a matter of days.
Colin Powell once said that the U.S. needed to get rid of him, and if it didn't get rid of him, the occupation wouldn't succeed. I imagine, I'm grotesque as it is even to discuss, that there are members of the U.S. military who still want to get rid of him. Is that even feasible?
I get a mixed message on that. I think the Americans always underestimated Sauter, and I never really understood that, but especially in 2003 and 2004, and they would speak about him, and I remember there was Dan Senor, who was the CPA spokesman, I think he called him a two-bit thug or something like that. You always knew that was the wrong language to use. Whatever you thought of Sauter, you knew that he was the son of this grand Ayatollah. You knew that he was a political figure that had a very significant constituency, and I never understood that kind of language as a way to describe him. It almost felt antagonistic in a way. I think they do understand Sauter's power at this point, and I think they're very worried that Sauter's lost control. So, I mean, part of me wonders, do they wish that Sauter would actually have more controls if they could engage him, or do they wish they would just get rid of him and hope the movement would collapse? The collapse of the movement, the utter collapse of the movement, I don't think is a good sign for the future of Iraq, because it would be this atomization, basically, of the militia into gangs that would have no kind of central hierarchy or whatever to try to wage control. So I'm not sure the Americans themselves know what to do at this point with Sauter.
Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post is my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. Do the Americans know what to do with Prime Minister Maliki? That's the other question I have.
They don't. And you wonder if you were in Maliki's position what you would be doing right now, because basically the Americans are saying that Maliki needs to execute an agenda that is an American agenda still at this point. And I think Maliki has a sense that if I do this, I'm going to forever lose credibility. The Americans are eventually going to leave. I'm going to have done their bidding. And how am I going to have my own, reputation or whatever if I'm perceived that way after the Americans leave? I think this gets to this question that I've always been struck by in Iraq, and that is this question of legitimacy. And how do you bring about a government that has legitimacy? And I think I was struck by that back in 2003. I think the question is even more relevant today, is how does Maliki generate his own legitimacy? And time and again, people still think that the Americans are the final arbiter in the country. And whoever does the Americans' bidding, by the very nature of that relationship, they lose legitimacy. And I think this is the question that's going on right now. I think some of the stuff that Maliki is saying at this point, criticizing the Americans' crackdown in Sauter City, for instance, recently, criticizing this idea of a timetable on how the progress of Iraqi security forces. I think a lot of this is oriented toward that question, that I need to maintain my own independence, I need to maintain my own reputation, my own credibility vis-a-vis the Americans to have any hope of legitimacy. And it's proved to be an elusive concept, this idea.
And what's the American strategy? I mean, I've heard rumors that the U.S. is planning to overthrow him. I mean, that would just kick over the whole table, wouldn't it?
It would. I mean, I think I don't know if there is a clear strategy at this point. I think there's maybe a greater awareness of how bad the situation is, but I don't know if I have a... I report there on the ground, so I'm not privy to the debates going on in Washington, but it's hard to see that there's a real clear strategy about how this is going to be changed, I guess, at this point. That, you know, these forces we've talked about that have been going on for 3 years, how you would dent them or not let them just keep going.
Now, those are indigenous forces, Anthony Shadid. Bush still talks about al-Qaeda in Iraq, and if the United States pulls out, that al-Qaeda would be in control of Iraq. Assess al-Qaeda's presence there.
You know, I think there's no question it has a presence. Is it a tight network that commands are given from some faraway country and then they're executed in Iraq? I don't get that sense. I think it's more of an ideological affiliation. But it definitely, it very self-consciously identifies itself as such. And I think a lot of Iraqis blame it for the unleashing of the sectarian bloodshed that we're seeing right now, that they did start the war. I mean, they did start killing Shiites in remarkable numbers. And I hate to use these terms, because I think it is so much more complicated than that. But I think overall Shiites there was a great deal of restraint on their part for the first 2 years. It's not that case anymore.
Now, the idea, though, that if the U.S. pulled out, that somehow al-Qaeda would control Iraq, given the power of the Shiites, seems implausible to me.
Yeah. I think what we're seeing now is what we'll see when the Americans withdraw, and that is that different parts of the country are under the control of different groups of armed men, basically. I mean, I think we're seeing that I think Western Iraq probably would be in the hands of some mix of al-Qaeda, Iraqi Islamists, you know, all of them armed, all of their kind of ideologies, this mix of religion and nationalism. I think what we'll see in southern Iraq is different cities under the control of different militias. I think we already see that to a certain degree now. And I think we probably would see Baghdad as being, like, we keep using this phrase, but a certain free-for-all as people.
Anthony Shadid, you say when the U.S. troops leave, when do you think that will be?
Well, that's a good question. And it's hard to see the American military withdrawing completely. I mean, you could see them hunkering down in big bases that are already established at this point, but, you know, perhaps withdrawing from this kind of street patrolling. And I have to say, when I was there last, recently, It you don't feel the American presence like you felt it, say, in 2005. I mean, I don't think I saw one American. The only American checkpoints I saw were near the airport, but in the streets themselves, as I was driving around, I didn't see any Americans. So I think, pardon me, I think at some point they have withdrawn a little bit. There are probably other neighborhoods where they're more aggressive.
What about this training that the U.S. brags about of the Iraqi military and the Iraqi police? To what extent is it simply training militias by night?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, I think they are arming people whose loyalty is first and foremost to what they would call a party, what other people would call a militia. You know, we're dealing with a situation that's becoming more and more existential. And what do I mean by that term? I mean, I think we're dealing with something where, you know, where certain Sunni parties, certain Shiite parties see one's loss as the other's gain. And I think in that kind of situation where it does feel so zero-sum, you know, those loyalties to the parties and to the militias become even more pronounced and even sharper. It's hard for me to see. You know, people will make the point that the Iraqi army, in contrast to the Iraqi police, has more of a national kind of ethos or a national sense. You know, that's not my feeling on it. I think, you know, we have seen these militias very strategically and in a very calculated way seize as much power as they can within these instruments of authority, and I think that's a line that's just going to keep going in the same direction.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post, author of Night Draws Near. You know, the haunting thing about your book, your great book, Night Draws Near, Anthony, is that you wrestle with the question of, could this have been done better? Was this inevitable? And toward the end of the book, you seem to go to the answer that maybe it was predetermined. And yet, some of the Iraqis you were talking to said, you know, if the U.S. overthrows Saddam and goes, great. No one seemed to really want or like Saddam.
Right.
And yet, there were so many blunders so early on that if it wasn't predetermined, certainly after, how long did they have to try to get it right? 6 months, 6 weeks, what was it?
You know, it didn't feel very long. And I'll tell you, I remember that day after, you know, I had covered the fall of Saddam on April 9th, and then I think I'd stayed up till 5 a.m., and then I woke up the next morning and was doing reporting in the streets. And, you know, Baghdad didn't suffer that much during the invasion itself. It suffered, and there was a horrific loss of life, especially toward the end of the war, when it felt like just random firing going on in the outskirts of the city. But Baghdad really was destroyed, was wrecked in those days after the fall of Saddam, when the looting happened, and it went unchecked, with some exceptions like the oil ministry. That period, those first few weeks after the fall of Saddam, I thought was decisive in determining how the American project or whatever we'd call it, occupation, was going to be perceived. And I, like you said, I think it was very short, that window. It was very brief. And I do feel that a lot of this stuff was inevitable. Not that we would have seen it beforehand, because nobody understood Sadr, for instance, or nobody understood the degree of religiosity that had taken shape in Iraq in the years before the invasion. But, you know, I do look back and I do feel that a lot of this was inevitable at a certain degree. People would, you know, differ on that. And, you know, inevitable doesn't mean that it has to have reached the point that it reached today. But were these forces going to take shape regardless of what happened? I think they probably were.
You know, one character in your book who is so riveting is this 14-year-old girl who is keeping a diary, Amal, right, who grows increasingly sophisticated throughout and outraged at what's going on at her country and becomes less of a young girl and more of an adult. Are you still in touch with her?
I just saw them on this most recent trip in October to Iraq. She's a remarkable girl. She's now 17 and getting ready to go to college. She had thought about becoming a journalist and then said, well, that's actually too dangerous of a job. So she's going to try to go into engineering. And she's, you know, and if anything, you know, when I sit with the family and I talk to them, she has such a sophisticated reading on what's going on around her. And she keeps, you know, when I talk to her, it gives me a certain faith in the future of Iraq, because it does feel so bleak right now. But she's always kept that hope. And I think the last time I saw her, this was a year ago, she had said, you know, as long as the sun keeps rising, there's going to be hope for the future. And she said the same thing to me again this most recent trip. And, you know, I did pause for a second, because as she was saying to me this, she said it with much less commitment, much less devotion, that she herself maybe doubted it at this point.
And she doesn't think of leaving?
Well, her family's so poor, I think it would be almost impossible for them to leave. You know, they just don't have enough money. Her mother just lost her job as a maid at a hotel that she'd been working at. Her brother had joined the Mahdi army, the militia of Muqtada Sadr. You know, there's actually, her mother and I were talking about a way to make sure she went to college, but it is difficult. And, you know, it is very expensive for a family that basically has nothing.
I hope you don't mind if I ask a kind of personal question, because you write in your book, Anthony Shadid, Night Draws Near, that you felt a certain ambivalence as an Arab American at seeing Baghdad fall. What is the ambivalence you feel now?
You know, I feel a lot of, I hate to be so pessimistic, but I feel very bleak about the region right now, and it makes me sad because it's obviously a place that I enjoy working in, enjoy living, and I've been there as a journalist nearly for more than a decade now. And I feel like, you know, the repercussions of this war we're just starting to feel, and I think it is going to reshape the region in a lot of ways, and not in good ways, and that worries me. You know, I think of, you know, for instance, family coming to visit me, and I realize that, you know, with an American passport, there are a lot of cities in the Middle East that people just won't be able to visit in, say, 5 or 10 years. And, you know, the Middle East was always remarkable to me, I think the Arab world, for the degree in which people made a distinction between the U.S. government or U.S. policy and Americans themselves. And I think especially before September 11th, I always felt that, almost made in every conversation. I never felt intimidated. I never felt at risk, to be honest, in any country that I worked in. And I think that's sadly changing at this point. I think we're dealing with a region that's become increasingly resentful, bitter, indignant in certain ways, and there are going to be repercussions of that. I'm not sure what those are going to be, but you feel that they are going to play themselves out.
It's not marching towards democracy the way Condoleezza Rice or George Bush say, now, is it?
I think it's the opposite, and I think it's probably one of the more dangerous moments, I think, in the Middle East since, I mean, what would you say, this 1967 Arab-Israeli war? I mean, you do feel that huge forces are taking shape, and I think religion is paramount. I think this question of identity, and it's something that I've often tried to focus on in my writing, is, you know, ideology at a certain level is dead in the Arab world. And these ideas of Arab nationalism, for instance, or communism, leftist ideologies that, whatever their success or failures, they spoke to an identity that transcended this more parochial sense of self, being Sunni, being Shiite, being Christian, being Kurd. That's no longer the case. And I think you're reaching a point right now in the Middle East, and especially in Iraq, where sectarian and ethnic identity, like I said, Sunni, Shiite, Christian, Kurd, however you describe it, is almost the sole axis around which politics revolve at this point. And they're by very nature exclusivist. They also don't promise much more in terms of, like, you know, of what a society would represent in terms of citizenship, in terms of a greater polity.
It's getting down to a very basic emotion that you deal with, Anthony Shadid, in Night Draws Near, the emotion of humiliation, which you write about a lot, and how that can become uppermost in people's minds, revenge, to take away that sense of humiliation. And a lot of the humiliation now is imposed by Washington. And so what is that harvest going to look like?
You know, I think I'm glad you raised that point, because it's such an important one. And I think the flip side of humiliation is dignity. And even when I was covering the war in Lebanon this past summer, I was struck by how often that word dignity came up. And it was, you know, I think it's, you know, I think in a culture like the United States, where it's a very powerful culture, a very self-confident culture, we don't maybe understand the power of those terms like humiliation or dignity. But in a place that feels besieged, that feels insecure, these concepts do take on a lot more meaning. And I think, you know, how do you respond to humiliation? How do you try to, you know, achieve dignity? I don't know the answer, but I know that a lot of people do ask these questions. And they're going to play themselves out in a very powerful way.
Well, we're going to have to watch that drama. Anthony Shadid, thanks so much for being my guest today.
It's my pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.